Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 178 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, as always, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jason.
Man, I keep thinking crypto is going to slow down, but it seems to become the opposite. There's just a lot of stuff going on. And I'm not even really sure where to get started, but let's just start talking about politics. The U.S. Senate Banking Subcommittee got together, and pretty much the conversation went that the U.S. needs to act now and pass crypto regulation. Otherwise, there's going to be some pretty high costs associated with that. And one is that other jurisdictions could pass rules that would really cause some friction if they're adopted globally. Like an example was when Europe did this for the strict rules on internet commerce a couple of decades ago. And the second is economic, where the U.S. is really already behind in 5G development and silicon chip manufacturing, and they don't want to be in the same spot with crypto. So it was interesting when they asked who they should be, I guess, following, and it's Singapore seems to be the country that everybody wants to be like right now, that's making the most sense with their crypto regulation. So kind of interesting. I think right now the plan looks like to have a draft out in August and then marked up in September. Although Cynthia Lummis seems that it's probably going to be done by like the end of the year. Right. So this is, I mean, we're talking about moving fast and we're talking about 6 months from now at this point.
Yeah. September seems like the absolute fastest warp speed time frame to get anything done. I mean, we're into July now. August is scrapped because they don't work in August. So I'd be shocked if they could get it done by the end of the year. You have August off, then you have September and October, and then you start using the holidays as excuses. So if it's not done by October, it's really hard to get something done. The only thing they seem to get done during the November, December timeframe is whenever they create a government stoppage because of they've got to pass some gigantic $2 trillion omnibus bill. Those are seems to be the only thing they'll get passed, or any action really that happens out of Washington. You know, Thanksgiving starts on November 1st and Christmas runs into early January. So,
yeah. Well, it is kind of interesting. I mean, we're talking about the U.S. not reacting fast enough. They're already reacting enough to where the European Union is now talking about allowing foreign-based stablecoins into their system, which they didn't want to do. But due to their really having a bunch of stringent restrictions on crypto issuers, they're really close to becoming almost a flyover zone between the U.S. and Asia when it comes to crypto. And I mean, they had almost a lead with the MiCA stuff, and now it's just been kind of a mess over there, and no one really knows what's going on. So I'm intrigued to see what happens here. I mean, they didn't want U.S.-based stablecoins in their system, and now it looks like it's going to happen because of what the U.S. is doing. You know, can Europe move faster and do something? I mean, they got 6 months at this point, or less than 6 months to do something. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't tell, the stablecoins thing's moving forward, whether you like it or not. If you're Europe, your people are going to use U.S. dollar stablecoins, whether you like it or not. Like, you might as well figure out how to create some guidelines and guardrails so that it doesn't get sideways. But quite frankly, if you're Europe, you're depending on the United States regulation to keep U.S. stablecoins pegged to a dollar, and whatever the rules that the U.S. has, you almost have to adopt them, because there's no how are you going to stop it? You know, I guess you can limit the apps that are built, but with AI, everybody's about to be able to create their own apps. And I mean, it won't be that hard for exchanges to pop up with AI doing a lot of the coding. So to me, you need to figure this out quick. If you're Europe, they won't. And Europe is kind of, you know, it happens when people start to get into crypto and Bitcoin. You get in a little bit, and then like you start to kind of second guess yourself, and you kind of back off a little bit. And then you do some research, you get in a little more, and then you go a little further, and then you back off of that. And so, and then at a certain point, like, the floodgates are open, right? And I mean, like, I'm pretty much there. So, and this is coming up on 8 years. So, you know, Europe's only on year like four or five probably. So, you know, they still got a long run. And, you know, if I was dictating the policy for a large number of people, I would probably, it would probably take me even longer to get all the way to the trapdoor where I'm like all in Michael Saylor style. I mean, yesterday I'm running the numbers on refinancing my primary residence. Like I can refi, even with today's rates, I can refi my primary residence, pay off pretty much all of my debts, excluding two large loans that I don't want to pay, and then buy a Bitcoin and change and be cash flow neutral on a monthly basis. And I'm like, this feels like a bull run calculation. Like it feels like the, you know, what can I do to get more Bitcoin? And that's a good thing. I mean, like bull runs need that. I mean, I'm feeling FOMO on Strike and Strife and Ethereum and all like stuff that I shouldn't, I haven't felt like I'm missing out on anything in years because I've been in Bitcoin. And so that's, you know, it definitely has this bull run feel right now. And so stuff like this with Europe, like, oh man, we need to kind of figure out our stablecoin stuff. Yeah, you do. Like, because you're going to have a few months where things are red hot and your people are going to be all over it and you're not going to be ready for it from a regulation standpoint. So, you know, they don't feel the bull run stuff like I do because they're busy drinking wine and talking about fiat stuff. But it's going to happen whether they like it or not.
Yeah. I was waiting for you to tell me that once you got that Bitcoin, you were going to get a loan on 50% of it to buy more Bitcoin from Strike or something like that too. So,
I mean, that's a possibility, man.
So one of the other things is that's being talked a lot about right now is this big, beautiful bill. And it is starting to get a crypto twist in a very small piece of it, but Cynthia Lummis is trying to get people to really stop the unfair tax treatment of crypto. If you look at what's going on with the Bitcoin miners and people that stake, they're currently taxed twice, once when they receive the tokens and then again when they sell. So what she's trying to do is change that in this big, beautiful bill, that all 1,000 pages of it. And hopefully some of it will be helpful for us. But yeah, I'm intrigued to see what happens with that and if that actually gets passed.
Yeah, I'm not convinced it's going to get passed, the bill in general. I'm curious to see what they do, because she's very vocal about this double taxation on the miners thing. And she's getting very vocal about a de minimis tax exemption for crypto and Bitcoin and expenditures under, I think it's under 200, maybe under 600. So if, you know, these giant bills, man, that's when you get stuff slipped through that, you know, you got to vote for this because we're going to, you know, the budget requires it. Meanwhile, there's 1,000 things buried in there that just kind of get through ski in the wake of the bigger bill. And so if we can get some Bitcoin, pro Bitcoin stuff to get in there, that'd be great. Cause I feel like everybody gets a piece, except for guys like us.
Yeah. I mean, and last week we talked about Ohio having that de minimis tax approval bill happen. There's just another senator that just submitted a Bitcoin reserve bill, I think, to buy up to like 10% Bitcoin for Ohio. So I'm intrigued to see if Ohio continues down that path, if the U.S. sees Ohio do this kind of first from this de minimis tax and actually adds that in. That'd be fantastic. We've been talking about this for 3-4 years at this point, something like that. I mean, it's, I would have thought it was here by now, but apparently not.
No, I we had to get this administration in that is kind of beholden to the industry to get some things done. And so Stablecoin Genius Act's through. So what's next, you know, market infrastructure stuff, and maybe we can slip some of these tax changes in too.
Yeah, I know the Arizona House passed another Bitcoin reserve bill that they kind of revived from the dead, although it is really just assets that are seized from criminal investigations that will be part of this Bitcoin reserve bill. It's not going to be anything that they end up buying on their own.
Yeah, it's better than Connecticut, which signed into law the bill that says that they ban Bitcoin reserves and crypto investments, which I can't wait to see if they have any S&P 500 index funds, because Coinbase is in there. And if they can't invest in any crypto, then S&P 500 and Russell 2000 is out. So let's see what their investments really look like.
That will be interesting. I did see Hester Pierce came out and said that in-kind redemptions for crypto ETFs are actually on the horizon. So that would be really intriguing to see if that happens sometime soon.
Yeah, if guys like us can move Bitcoin into and out of ETFs, like, I think that would be interesting to see. I wonder if some people that are just uncomfortable with their self-custody would be like, fine, take it. Hold my Bitcoin, custody my Bitcoin for me, take my 0.2% or whatever, and then if something happens to me, it's super easy for it to be inherited. You know, it's a little more logical or a little more typical to get loans against holdings in your brokerage account and stuff like that. So I'd be curious to see what happens there. I would have to imagine that more Bitcoin would move in to the ETFs then would move out.
To me, I think it's something that the older generations would feel a lot more comfortable with. So I believe that that would allow them to feel more confident about what's going to happen since, shoot, I mean, self-custody is not a simple thing, right? It's a necessary thing, but it's up to you to do everything properly. And if you screw it up, it's gone. So this allows you to put that in somebody else's hands that theoretically you can trust a little bit more. I don't know if you can trust too much more. I don't know if I put 100% in there. Split things up with all the craziness going on with wrench attacks and everything else. It's probably good to have it in other split up in different places anyways.
Yeah, and I mean, there's the edge cases for this are like astronomical. All right, so self-custody edge case, you lose your private keys or you have a problem. And you, instead of having one Bitcoin, you have zero, which is a disaster. Edge case for the ETFs, they're rehypothecating or they're playing games with by getting loans or loaning out Bitcoin or paper Bitcoin or whatever. And FTX crashes and maybe you don't get zero, but you got to wait 2 or 3 years and you get like the cash equivalent or the dollar equivalent of whatever you lost. Or edge case two, the government's just captures the Bitcoin in the ETFs or MicroStrategy or whatever that they talk about. So, you know, to me, if you have a good self-custody plan, you're probably fine and you understand it. Great. You shouldn't be using it all the time. It should be figure it out once, lock it in, and then, you know, find a place to hide or keep your keys safe. And then on the ETF side, it's just, I mean, it's with everything else. I mean, it's like a bank, it's like any other banking password, safety, security, you know, you're subject to cyber attacks or whatever else, but you know, at least it's a lot like everything else. So I agree. I mean, for people that aren't spending the 40 to 100 hours to get into Bitcoin, they just want to get some exposure. The Bitcoins, the ETFs make sense. That's why I feel like some people that got into Bitcoin self-custody and then aren't comfortable with it would move their Bitcoin into the ETFs. But a lot of the people that got into the Bitcoin ETFs, I don't know that they would move it out unless it sounded like they're having some custody issues with Coinbase.
Yeah.
Now, as soon as they do, as soon as anybody hears Coinbase is having, you know, an issue, there would be a huge run. Like all of those big investors and institutions would quickly figure out a self-custody route. And there'd be a huge run on Bitcoin coming out of Coinbase if something like that does happen. It'd be like Silicon Valley Bank, except instead of happening over like 12 hours, it would happen over 2. And it would be 10 times as much money flowing out.
Yeah, you mentioned looking into refinancing the home. So the U.S. housing chief apparently let Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae know that they need to start getting ready to accept crypto assets for mortgages and also crypto as a payment. They didn't really talk about which cryptos yet, but that's kind of interesting because that hasn't been the case since this started, but now they're viewing it as an actual asset that can be used both to qualify for a loan and to pay a loan.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't read the part where it said to pay the loan, but just the fact that you can hold that asset and it counts towards your qualification for a mortgage is valuable because you don't have to you don't have to make a decision on, ah, man, should I get out of this crypto position and into something that'll be recognized as I try to get a loan. So I think it's helpful. It's probably helpful for a small number of people. I think it's more of a signal that things are starting to shift our way in like traditional financial rails. And so I'll take it.
Yep. We've been talking about Circle a lot here lately. They just applied for a national banking license, which would allow them to act as a custodian for their own reserves. It would also allow them to hold crypto assets for institutional investors. So more reason why people are continuing to be very bullish on what's going on with Circle these days.
Yeah, Circle, the whole stablecoin thing's looking good. So Circle's strike while the iron's hot. Try to get your banking license. Like, you got the right administration in. I mean, Custodia Bank's been trying to get one for 6 years or something crazy and hasn't been able to. But Circle, I mean, well, I've said it for years. Circle is created to play by the rules. And when you play by the rules, you know, you can get your back scratched and stuff like that. And that might be part of it.
Speaking of another company that's done pretty well, Coinbase, they are planning to launch U.S. perpetual futures on July 21st, which the crazy part is more than 90% of this entire market share of perpetual futures has been outside of the U.S. So bringing it back to the U.S. should be quite a bit of income that Coinbase will get, hence why their stock is doing pretty well right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Coinbase is all-time highs and keeping going. So they got a huge advantage that, like, the first mover stuff in Bitcoin and crypto is such a monster advantage that, you know, Circle's, we talk about Circle, but Tether's still way ahead. Coinbase is way ahead of everybody else. MicroStrategy is way ahead of everybody else. The first mover strategy and benefits are huge. And Coinbase continues to act as a fairly young company doing things like perpetual futures. They're, you know, they're finding different ways to grow. So I'm, you know, I keep an eye on Coinbase.
Yeah. So one other thing that Coinbase is working on, although somebody else beat him to the punch, Denari is a platform that is offering tokenized stock trading. And it just became the first company to secure U.S. approval to offer blockchain-based instruments. So that's kind of interesting. Of course, Coinbase and Kraken both are trying to get the same thing, but Denari is going to have this little bit of a lead at some point. I don't know when they're going to start rolling things out, but the tokenized stock trading, it's coming.
It's definitely coming. I also read that Robinhood was really close to launching their tokenized stock trading. So it seemed as though Robinhood's going to hold the stocks, create the tokens, issue the tokens, and then the tokens can trade, and then I suppose be redeemable for the stocks that Robinhood holds. I didn't get too deep into it, but it's coming. If somebody's going to figure it out and launch it, and then the SEC will either bite them or not. So we'll see.
Yeah. So Robinhood is launching their own L2. It's going to be based on Arb. It is optimized for tokenized RWAs. Those tokenized stocks are going to be only available in the EU for now, and it's going to be about 200 stocks and ETFs. Even the dividends, you'll get the dividends on that too. So I think Gemini also announced that they're going to have tokenized stocks in the EU, the first one being Strategy, which should be interesting. But I mean, Robinhood is still in development with their L2. I think they plan to support 24/5 trading and self-custody and bridging and all that kind of stuff. So they say that U.S. users are going to be getting Ethereum and Solana staking soon, which was launched for EU users about a year ago. And the other kind of interesting piece to what Robinhood's doing is they're going to allow users to pick the tax lot for crypto, which means you can choose which Bitcoin you want to sell when you do that. So could be beneficial.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's definitely interesting.
CrainShares had an interesting announcement too. They are planning to list a Coinbase 50 index ETF, which they will track the 50 largest digital assets by market cap. So currently it would be about 50% Bitcoin, 21% Ethereum, 9% Ripple, and then it kind of goes down from there. So kind of goes back to our top 10 that we talked about years ago.
Crypto 10, man. We were ahead of the curve big time. We could have turned our closed-ended fund into an ETF by now if we knew what the heck we were doing back then.
Yeah. The other really interesting ETF announcement that I saw was Rex Osprey, which is a company that is apparently planning to launch a Solana staking ETF on Wednesday, so tomorrow, July 2nd. What they're doing is using this old 1940 Act and a C-Corp structure to bypass the SEC delays tied to the staking regulations. They also have an Ethereum version that has staking too, but they haven't really made a lot of comments on when that's going to be launching. But they've come back and said the SEC doesn't have any comments back from it, so they're launching at least a Solana one on Wednesday, which is going to be the first staking ETF in the U.S.
Good. I mean, the staking looks like dividends, and ETFs, like they're sold through brokerage accounts, and that'll make a lot more sense. So I think that'll probably attract quite a bit of funds. And it's just the easier it is to explain this stuff, the better. I mean, that's why, you know, Bitcoin is not like anything else, but there's a gazillion allegories that people create, you know, digital gold or whatever, just to help people try to understand it. And so it's like, they call the dividend staking is way easier than understanding proof of stake. So, you know, it's just a shortcut. So I think that'll probably be good for Solana and Ethereum when they get it.
So let's talk about strategy. I feel like we always got to talk about strategy at some point. I bought another $532-ish million of Bitcoin, which is, I think, 4980. So they're up to 497,325 Bitcoin, just probably one buy away from 600,000 Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah. I mean, you could pretty much round that up to 600,000, I think.
Most of that, I think they sold at the money options of their MSTR stock, but some of the Strike and Strife was sold too. I think the big thing yesterday at the end of June was, as long as Bitcoin wasn't below 95,000, that they'll qualify for the S&P. I think it stayed around 106, 107,000. So theoretically, they should be qualified for the S&P now. I don't know how quickly that's going to happen, but that will be extremely exciting if they get included into that index here pretty soon.
Yes. So I always look at their cost basis. You know, they have almost 600,000 Bitcoin at an average price of $71,000 per Bitcoin. So, you know, we're in this spot. You know, Bitcoin just closed June. It's the highest monthly close ever at 107,000. You know, do you feel like there's a 30-35% downside risk to Bitcoin right now? I'm like, no. Like in a black swan, or like some, you know, two sigma event or something that happens and crashes everything, then I can see, you know, getting to like 70,000 seems like a mile away. It seems farther away than 200. So that's a good, so MicroStrategy is sitting pretty there. They, you know, closing, you know, their quarter two close was $107,000 Bitcoin. That puts them right at $11 billion in net income for Q2. That, when they have their earnings call in a month, that I think that's going to shake some things up when they have an $11 billion net income. That does qualify them for the S&P 500, but then qualifying and getting included, you know, takes a while. Tesla took quite a while because of the volatility of the stock. You know, they don't want to put somebody in the S&P 500 that then has to be removed immediately because they drop back out. So it might take a few quarters for them to actually be listed. I do think there's going to be a ton of money front running that inclusion into the S&P 500. Because with the S&P 500 comes a lot of just passive funds flowing into the stock. With that, a lot of all that money is going to get turned into Bitcoin, right? I mean, like MicroStrategy comes up with these STRK, STRF, STRD preferred stock sales and buys Bitcoin with it. They just made a dividend payment on Strike and Strife, I think. And then a lot of that got dripped back into those funds. Like a lot of people just reinvest the dividends. So they just basically paid dividends, got the money back, bought more Bitcoin with it, which is like hilarious if you're a MicroStrategy guy. And I'm starting to really like enjoy watching it. Strike and Strife's price has just climbed to like $130 a share. you know, and they pay $8 and $10 a share in dividends. So, you know, the market's saying 8 and 10%. You know, they're supposed to be $100. They're supposed to be targeted at $100 a share, so that they're 8 and 10% dividends. And the market says 8 and 10% is way too high. We're more than happy to take 7%, 6%. So that's definitely worth watching as the market kind of tells, the market determines what the Bitcoin interest rate, what the risk-free rate on Bitcoin appears to be, something like that. And it's, I mean, it's not that far away from the risk-free rate from government bonds, which is kind of funny. It looked like the demand for the Commons stock went up. So MicroStrategy bought at the ATM. They bought Bitcoin using common shares. $519 million of the $532 million in that this week's purchase was common shares dilution. So that's kind of back to the old ways. I mean, we had 4 weeks where we didn't sell a share. And so no big deal. The stock broke 400 for the first time in a long time. And everybody tends to talk about the MicroStrategy all-time high being like $535 a share. But that day it closed at like $400 a share. I mean, it was like a huge intraday spike. And so, you know, $400 a share for MicroStrategy is pretty high. You know, you're also considering there's a lot more Bitcoin and a lot more Bitcoin per share in the company than there was back when we had kind of the crazy volatility and prices jumping. So MicroStrategy is fun to watch. It's super interesting. It definitely has the same feel. Like sometimes, especially early on in Bitcoin, you're researching it. You're like, man, I like this. This is neat. And then you learn some more stuff and you don't have time to figure it out. And then more stuff pops up. You don't have time to figure it out. And MicroStrategy is the same way. It's almost like, hey, I think it's going to work. I need to buy some. When I can pay attention, great. But I don't have time to figure it all out and then invest. Like, I need to figure out enough to where I'm comfortable and I invest, I allocate a position. And then when I have time, I'll figure it out. Like it's getting quite complicated, right? I mean, their preferred shares, they're selling common share at the ATM in order to pay the dividends on the preferred stock, which they used to buy the Bitcoin months ago. So, you know, that's kind of a funky thing to do. And then, you know, surprise, when you pay your dividends, you actually just get to turn around and buy more Bitcoin with. So it's a crazy thing to watch. Nobody else is doing stuff to this level. You've got some copycats. I mean, Metaplanet's really hammered down. I mean, I feel like two or three times a week they're announcing different things instead of, you know, MicroStrategy seems to have a beat on every Monday they come out with an announcement. But Metaplanet, it's like three times this week had different announcements on Bitcoin buys or different vehicles they're using or refinancing convertible notes and things like that. So they're putting the work in.
A quick break from the podcast to talk about a little PDF I put together for everybody. I've been in crypto since about 2018 and made a lot of mistakes. And the one thing I always get asked is, what would you do differently if you got in today? So what I've done is created a PDF that talks about the 10 mistakes that I've made and how not to make those mistakes ever again. If you're interested, you can check the link in the show notes or go to www.jasonexplainscrypto.com/10 and get access to that PDF. That's the number 10 not spelled out. Back to the podcast. Yeah, I think Metaplanet bought another 1,005 Bitcoin or something like that. So it's up to 13,350, which, I mean, that's great, but it's, I mean, we talked about Strategy just bought almost 5,000 this week. So it's still kind of just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You're going to have to sell Bitcoin bonds to sovereign wealth funds or to countries in order to catch MicroStrategy. I don't think there's a company that can do it. I think you're going to have to, like, I think the 21 company with Jack Mallers and Cantor Fitzgerald and their connections with governments is the only thing that can be done to get. I mean, they have a 600,000 Bitcoin lead. That's a big lead when as you're buying Bitcoin, that lead gets larger in dollar when denominated in dollars. And having 1 foot in dollars and 1 foot in Bitcoin, like, they just get further and further apart. So, you know, I think the Bitcoin backed bond gives you an opportunity to get big money in, buy big tranches of Bitcoin at a time, and maybe early enough that you can catch them, or you could get close. But like, second, you're fighting for second place now.
Yeah. Well, Metaplanet did pass Tesla's holdings, so they jumped up on the list there. And they're not,
think about that. Bigger.
I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, Tesla's huge. They're a Mag7 company. They got tons of cash. They have tons of money. They got tons of, you know, going forward, they've got the Optimus robots. They've got self-driving cars. They just launched robo taxis. You know, they're competing with the Waymo cars that look stupid and cost almost 10 times as much. You know, I mean, Tesla's, they bought $1 billion worth of Bitcoin or whatever it was 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And then a company that owns one hotel in Japan just passed them. Like, dang, that's dumb. Like, but they're doing a lot of good things over at Tesla, but they could activate their treasury. I mean, they're so active in every other way, and then they just let the treasury sit. It's a missed opportunity for them.
Yeah, but there's a ton of other companies now that had some interesting news too. So Bakkt, which is a publicly traded crypto custody company here in Atlanta, they just announced they're looking to raise $1 billion to form their Bitcoin treasury. So there's $1 billion there. Green Minerals, which is a Norwegian mineral mining firm, said they're planning to invest up to $1.2 billion in a Bitcoin stockpile, although their stock plunged 35% when that was announced. I think that might be one of the few stocks that's plunged when they've announced they're going to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, it's they're popping left and right. And I mean, you just named a couple $1 billion announcements. There's tons of hundred millions, several hundred million, tens of millions. Like, there's a lot of corporations that are saying that they're going to buy Bitcoin. 21 and Jack Mallers actually said, here are the addresses where we hold the Bitcoin. And I think that might be a little bit of a differentiator with these Bitcoin treasury companies, is the ones that actually prove that they have it, instead of the ones, like, because a lot of these are, we're going to buy this, we're raising the money to buy this Bitcoin. It's not purchased Bitcoin yet. And so I think the ones that actually show that they bought it are going to be able to put themselves out a little bit. But I mean, at this point, it's becoming commoditized, and it's going to be a marketing game. Who can market themselves best? We'll see.
There's a Vivendi Coffee, which they just approved a plan to invest up to €1 billion in Bitcoin. This is a coffee place in Spain that has 6 locations in one city. They recently purchased 20 more Bitcoin and now have 54 in total. And then now they plan on buying $1 billion. They would become the largest publicly listed Bitcoin holding company in Spain if they do this. I mean, this is crazy. And then there was a Canadian company that I was reading about, Tahini's. Back in 2020, they invested their cash reserves into Bitcoin.
Yeah, these guys are awesome.
Yeah, they had like 7 in 2020, and now they have 62 restaurants. Each restaurant, they put a Bitcoin ATM in there that brings about $250 Canadian per month in. They keep all that in a separate account for each location. So now each restaurant now has about $40,000 in Bitcoin in their own account. But it was, I mean, these guys, I think, had Egyptian roots, and they saw the Egyptian dollar lose like 85% of its value over more than a decade. Their parents apparently saw the currency devalued like 50% in a single month at one point. So they just jumped all into Bitcoin, and it has turned into almost a blessing for them. So more stories like that are going to be cool to hear about.
Yeah, no, I remember those guys, because even in like the doldrums of like the Bitcoin winter, when everything's down in bear market, there's just no noise. They're like on Twitter, like, we bought more Bitcoin. I mean, constantly. And like you said, they had 6 little, I mean, they're like kebab shops. You know, they're not, it's, this isn't like a, you know, fine dining chops, $100 a plate kind of places. I mean, but guess what? if you've got Bitcoin as your treasury, whatever your business is just mining fiat to convert it into Bitcoin, and then the Bitcoin grows. And I mean, think about how valuable it is now that you can get loans against your Bitcoin, or your Bitcoin is can be used as an asset when you're looking at refinancing something. Because no matter what, you know, especially small businesses, your livelihood is based on how well you can play the finance game, and it doesn't matter what widgets you sell. And so if you're just stashing Bitcoin away because it's going to be more and more valuable over time, but you can use that perceived value without actually cashing it in, selling it and getting rid of it, you can just get loans and fiat against it, then the value of that's huge for these small businesses. I mean, it's only, you know, the reason why a lot of these like McDonald's, you know, they're a real estate company that sells hamburgers to fund the real estate. So Tahini's is a kebab shop, or it's a Bitcoin company that sells kebabs to fund the Bitcoin. You know, it's the same model, but instead of the real estate, it's Bitcoin. It's like, it's one of the reasons why I can't start another business. It's like, I'm going to start another business so I can buy more Bitcoin. Like, that's, I don't want more dollars. Like, I'm going to just buy more Bitcoin with them. So, like, once you start getting into this stuff, man, it kind of messes your brain up.
So speaking of Bitcoin, Kazakhstan just announced that they plan to establish a state Bitcoin and crypto reserve. So it is, I think specifically they said crypto, so it's not just Bitcoin, but they have about 13% of the global Bitcoin hash rate currently. Yeah. So it's kind of a big deal. I mean, it's going to be interesting, and kind of tying this into what's going on in Pakistan. We've been talking about Pakistan here the past couple of weeks and how they're trying to get into the whole mining Bitcoin space and Bitcoin reserves. Well, the IMF is really fighting hard to get Pakistan to kind of step back. It's interesting. Pakistan owes the fourth biggest amount of money to the IMF out of all the countries out there. But it's, the IMF has really gone after any country that has said they want to incorporate Bitcoin and crypto into their space. And I mean, it's probably worth kind of talking about what's going on and why that's happening and the playbook behind what IMF is doing and what we're seeing with them and some of the African countries and Bhutan and all that kind of stuff. So I did see, like, the big thing is one of the ways that it's, I guess, help the Bitcoin story is helping these companies or countries is it's reducing remittance costs, right? We've talked about this a lot in the past. If you look at El Salvador, IMF mentioned Bitcoin 221 times in their loan conditions here in 2025. So they think it's a big deal. Pakistan right now loses about $1.8 billion annually on remittances. El Salvador said they've saved about $4 million annually, although they only have about 1.1% of people using the Bitcoin remittance adoption. So you look at Nigeria, they had $21 billion in remittances last year. So there's a huge amount of money that all of a sudden Bitcoin can save a ton of people a lot of money. And when they do this, the reliance on the IMF goes way down.
Yeah. And I mean, on the remittance side, it doesn't have to be Bitcoin. It can be stablecoins. Yeah. Like, so it's such a poacher's game that they're going to find ways around it. And as soon as one group finds a way to get payments in and pay 10% of the fees that their neighbors are paying, then their neighbors are going to start using that, because nobody's going to just give money away when your neighbor isn't. And so, like, the remittance thing, I like that. It's one of my favorite things, because, like, Western Union and these guys, they don't need money. let these people keep their money. And so that's one piece. The IMF, you know, if you don't know anything about it, basically they're a loan shark organization that makes loans and then dictates all the rules of how you run your country because of the loans that they've made to your country. So it's like, it's not nation building in the, you know, it's not boots on the ground, regime change, nation building kind of thing. It's just influencing the governments by loan sharking. And then, you know, guess what? The loans are denominated in US dollars. If the country's not a US dollarized nation, then they have their own local currency, which over time typically loses to the dollar. And so those loans become unpayable in their local currency. So they refinance them and move forward. Or they do what countries like El Salvador did and just adopt, get rid of their local currency and adopt the US dollar, which makes the US dollar stronger. The IMF is really an arm of the US. It's not, as much as they want to be global, it's, I can't remember what their funding is, 90% from the US. It's a US organization. So it's super like strong army, loan sharky organization that kind of pushes countries around. Once you're in debt to them, you got to do what they say. I mean, El Salvador is still buying one Bitcoin a day, even though they're not supposed to, which is cool with me. I don't know exactly how they're getting away with it and not get being a breach, but like, honestly, is the IMF going to smash them just because they're buying one Bitcoin a day, you know, and they say, oh, well, it's coming out of a different fund or whatever, like to make it seem all right. But, you know, every time I hear about Kazakhstan, every time I've ever heard about Kazakhstan in my entire life, it's been about Bitcoin mining. It's like, it's a trivia question about like, name the seven countries that end in Stan. And other than that, it doesn't pop up in my life at all. And so it makes sense to me that they're going to get some Bitcoin on their country's balance sheet and move forward. Pakistan makes sense. The reason the IMF is doing what they're doing is so that when Pakistan says we want to put Bitcoin on our balance sheet, they can say, no, you can't. That's that there's a lot of power that comes with those loans. I did read that Bhutan is mining Bitcoin with their excess hydroelectric power, and they're not interested in selling it anymore. They're just going to keep it as a reserve. So they're going to shift their strategy on that. So that's like more and more countries are coming on board or making those efforts and moving in that direction.
Well, I think Bhutan, they gave like all their employees a 50% raise by selling some of the Bitcoin, and now they have free healthcare. So now they're good. But so now they're just going to go back to keeping all the Bitcoin. And if you look, I mean, that's one of the things that Bitcoin mining has done, is really turn this energy into debt-free wealth. And it's kind of flipped this script on the whole stranded energy concept. And when you look at Paraguay, I think they're earning like $50 million a year from hydro mining. Bhutan got like $1.1 billion in Bitcoin, which is over a third of their GDP. But it's all these developing countries are so energy rich, but they're debt poor. So they use these IMF loans for infrastructure. But those loans, most of them, they demand this cheap energy export or resource concession when the default hits. And that's been one of the big issues. I mean, you look at like Argentina, who, by the way, is the country in the most debt to IMF, like $32 billion. They borrow the US dollars to bolster their currency reserves and stabilize their currency. But when it goes the wrong way, they are forced to sell off these strategic assets that they own. And that kind of just kills the country. I was reading that if Argentina would have taken 1% of its reserves in Bitcoin in 2018, it would have offset the peso's 90% devaluation that year, which would have allowed them to sidestep the IMF bailout, which is just wild. 1%. That's all it took.
Well, Argentina, man, my entire life, it's been kind of a crummy country, but they were crushing it. Like, they're resource rich. There's a ton of reasons why Argentina should be a wealthy to quite wealthy country, maybe not a G7, but a G20 kind of country. But they just, you know, their government's a communist socialist, you know, the Mikhail stuff ought to start coming through eventually. And, you know, they can turn it around like Bukele did. Like, I mean, you know, El Salvador was going to just keep going down the same road they had with all the gang problems and crime and everything else. You know, you just had a guy stand up, surround himself with people that wanted to solve the problem and solve the problem. So Argentina can do the same thing. It just needs to happen. And once it does, $32 billion. I mean, we just named a bunch of hotel companies and restaurants and coffee shops that raised $1 billion. Argentina ought to be able to come up with $32 billion on a short enough term basis that you could deem it realistic. And that, I mean, all these countries, they have so much hydroelectric power, and it's like, it seems like a great project when you build it, but they just spill water over, right? Like they have too much power and not enough consumption, so they got to dump water. You don't have to do that if you throw miners in there. You can spin the turbines and run the electrons and turn into Bitcoin, and then you turn the Bitcoin into money or wealth. Either way, like, better than just pouring water from a high elevation to a low elevation. So I don't know. As countries do this, and I talked about this years ago, when El Salvador does it, Costa Rica and the nearby similar countries have got to pay attention. And so, you know, it's slowly starting to happen with the Pakistans and Kazakhstans and, you know, Bhutan and El Salvador, Panama. You know, it's they're starting to look at it. So it's just so freaking slow. It's shockingly slow.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too that it allows for is this evading sanctions and trade restrictions. And we've seen that Iran in the late 70s, Venezuela in 2017, Russia here recently in 2022. And not that I'm agreeing with what any of those countries are doing, but countries like Iran are able to monetize its energy exports through mining. And then they don't actually have to sell the power anywhere. They can use the Bitcoin. And I think one of the big benefits that I saw is we've talked about Afghanistan a lot in the past. There's an NGO called Code to Inspire that uses Bitcoin donations, which the big thing is it can't be intercepted by the Taliban. And then it turns that allow, and it trains women to write software, right? So, I mean, there, that's not allowed. And if they knew the dollars were getting to that somehow, they, of course, would be taken. But with Bitcoin, they're able to kind of get through all those roadblocks and get it to where it needs to go. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm an American, and yeah, countries step out of line. We have the power. We sanction them. You know, it's probably net good. But they get around the sanctions by selling oil to China or natural gas to China or whatever. I mean, they're getting around the sanctions either way. So Bitcoin is just another tool for them to get around sanctions. Bitcoin wasn't created so that Iran and Russia could evade U.S. sanctions. It just happens that you can't stop it. So that's just part of what you get when you have an asset. It's the same with gold. So, I mean, as much as we want to, like, oh man, Bitcoin's terrible. Look how it enriches Iran. We gave them $1.7 billion in cash under the Obama administration. It's like, what games are we playing? Do we really care? You know, we flew pallets of cash to them. So allowing them to transact in Bitcoin, not allowing them to, but pretending to be upset that they transact in Bitcoin, it's not holding water for me.
Yeah. I think the other big thing that needs to happen more of is these grassroots Bitcoin economies. I mean, you've been to El Salvador's Bitcoin Beach, right? There's South Africa's Bitcoin Ekazi. More of that needs to really start happening. And as a lot of these, we're starting to see a lot of that happen in Africa with the microgrids and them taking their stranded energy and turning it into something and making it worthwhile for those locations. As that continues to happen, I think we'll start to see more and more of that pop up and people really understand the power of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I heard that there's another town in El Salvador that's even more dedicated to a Bitcoin circular economy than Bitcoin Beach, so in El Zante. So it's like I said, man, stuff, once your neighbor starts to figure something out, it's not long before you're doing it too. Like the network effects are like undeniable. I mean, it happened with the internet, it happened with mobile phones, like it's gonna happen with Bitcoin, except with the internet, you had to buy a computer and figure out how to use it. With mobile phones, you had to buy a smartphone, you know, and get off of the flip phone or put a car phone in your car. You know, I mean, there's all this hardware that had to happen and you had to get used to carrying a cell phone with you all the time. With Bitcoin, you don't need to buy anything other than converting US dollars into Bitcoin using your smartphone or your computer or whatever. So the adoption ought to be quicker. Especially since with Bitcoin, you're not paying a monthly fee for the new mobile phone. You're not paying for internet access. You're not, like, you're saving money by using it. So, and you're saving money on transaction fees by using it if you're using it for transactions, and you're gaining wealth by holding it if you're using it as a store of value. So the adoption is, you know, everybody talks about oh, we're in 1998 or 1999 in internet adoption terms. I'm like, yeah, but it's going to go way faster once things pick up, because you don't have to have people buy, you don't need to wait for Dell, and you don't have to wait for Internet Explorer to come out and Netscape. Like, you don't need all that. It's already there. Like, the only thing that we need is like Lightning Network or something similar, L2, on the transaction per second side, so that, you know, Bitcoin can be used as a medium of exchange. But that's not a pressing need. If it was a pressing need, someone would have created it by now. So, like, that's the way innovation works. Like, and the world needing something is why it gets created. You know, very rarely is something created that and gets adopted because that no one really needs. So I'm really not sweating it, and I think things are going to go faster than I expect, even though I just talked about how slow things are moving when you talk about some of these countries.
Oh, you talk about countries moving slow. We've talked about Germany in the past and some of the mistakes they made, being one of the countries that held the most Bitcoin to selling it all and owning nothing. The largest banking group over there, Sparkson, is going to start allowing crypto trading for its retail customers. Now, this comes 3 years after the board decided not to do it because of volatility and risk. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, let's do it. This makes sense. So they're starting to see the light. And I mean, if Germany and that group can see it, then I have a feeling everybody else is going to start seeing it, too, because they've been fighting it hard for a while.
Yeah, I mean, and like Germany, you know, it's not like the same entity as selling 50,000 Bitcoin and then offering Bitcoin trading on a platform. But, you know, every country just seems like that, you know, it's just wheels spinning in mud to get traction on this adoption stuff. So, you know, this is one of those times where you gain a little traction, you hit a little dry spot, and you move forward. So that's a good thing for them.
Well, let's talk about Kraken real quick. I know they're kind of forgotten about since Coinbase is one of the leaders here, but they just secured a MiCA license in Ireland to scale their EU operations. So that should be good for them. I think we've talked about Ireland and how much they need to be getting more involved in things like Bitcoin and crypto, just because there's not a lot else there that they can do. So they need to be the leader in that space. And then the other thing that Kraken is debuting is an app called Krak, K-R-A-K. It's going to really compete with Venmo and PayPal and Cash App. So it's going to provide free local payments, zero cost international transactions to more than 160 countries. You're going to be able to earn 4.1% holding their USDG stablecoin, and theoretically up to 10% staking rewards on their cryptos. They're going to enable what they're going to call crack tags, which is similar to the ENS, Ethereum naming system. They're also planning to integrate a crypto credit line where you can borrow against your digital holdings, kind of like what Strike has done. And I was trying to figure out, well, if you're offering this for free, how are you going to make money? And they said, most of the fees it's going to make is when people swap one asset to another, they're going to take a cut there. So, I mean, good for them jumping into this. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty cool little app. I'll be intrigued to see how it competes at the end of the day. But yeah, competition's good.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're cracking, you got to start trying. You got to make a move. You got to do something. I mean, like Elon Musk announced that X is going to be like a payment platform and expand what they're doing. So it seems like that's like the everything app that people have talked about for a decade is like people are actually trying to make that happen now. So it's probably going to be annoying, but honestly, it feels like every time I check into a hotel, I have to download an app right now. So it would be nice to be like, all right, I just go to this one app and it does all my stuff. And if that's cracking, I can't imagine. The name Crack is not the best, to be honest.
If you're going to get addicted to something, I guess that's the kind of crack to get addicted to.
I guess, man, but that's a tricky one. So we'll see where it goes. But yeah, I mean, we need to see some movement. And if, you know, companies like Kraken that I trust that know that they've watched FTX fail and 3 Arrows Capital and Terra Luna, like they've survived all that stuff. And so like those companies, I feel like I can kind of trust. The new companies popping up that solve all these problems make me super cautious about believing that they're not going to screw themselves and go bankrupt.
Yeah. Another interesting piece of news that I saw. So BitMine just announced that they plan to raise $250 million, which seems small compared to some of the numbers we've been talking about earlier, but they're also planning to shift its Bitcoin treasury strategy over to Ethereum. And with the other money, they'll end up boost their Ethereum holdings by more than 16x, and they'll become the largest corporate holder of Ethereum. The other interesting piece is Tom Lee is also going to be appointed as the chairman of the board of directors, and talking about a guy that can kind of keep up with Michael Saylor and Jack Mallers, he's definitely one of those guys that is on the circuit talking about crypto all the time as well.
Oh, yeah. I've got a friend who watches CNBC all the time and basically sends me a text message every time Tom Lee's on there talking about $1 million Bitcoin and $250,000 Bitcoin this year and stuff like that. So I was actually kind of surprised to see Tom Lee become the chairman of Bitmine and convert from Bitcoin to Ethereum, because, I mean, yes, the Bitcoin treasury company move is becoming crowded, but it's not crazy crowded. I mean, it's still a very small number of companies. And if, you know, the Ethereum treasury company is wide open, but every time people do it, it seems like the stock price goes down. Now, Bitmine's stock price shot up when Tom Lee announced that. And so we'll see what happens. But I think they had a $25 million market cap when they announced that. So there's a ton of room to go up when you're a $25 million company. Like, I've helped run and grow a $25 million company. It's pretty small. Like if you're I was a top three guy at a $25 million company. That's me. And that was a decade ago.
So larger companies then, Tether is a pretty large one. Their CEO just came out and talked about in 15 years, he's expecting 1 trillion AI agents to be using Bitcoin and USDT. So that, I mean, that's not too far away. And if you're having a trillion AI agents using that because it's a thing that nobody else can really stop, and you're not going to have the JP Morgans of the world opening up bank accounts for AI agents, then it's going to be really intriguing to see just how quick all this moves here in the next 15 years.
Yeah, I do think when David Sacks was named the AI and crypto czar, I was like, man, that's kind of weird to smash those two together. But those two are converging in almost every way. Mm-hmm. The mining companies are kind of also these AI data warehouse companies. The AI agents are going to use crypto or Bitcoin to transact because they can create wallets, but they can't create bank accounts. Also, why would they? When you can interact, when you can skip the whole banking thing, it's like Africa skipping telephone lines and just going straight to mobile. Like, if you can skip the banking infrastructure and delays and fees and just go straight into Tether and stablecoins where you're paying almost no fees, you should do that. So a trillion's a lot. I mean, that's like 10 AI agents for every human being on Earth, including the ones that have never seen electricity. Like, that's a lot. So, but I mean, I believe it. They can pop up and spin up all day long. You know, I've got different AI agents for different areas of my life. Whenever I have a question or I want to talk about something, I go to that AI agent that I created and ask it questions, and it is kind of geared up for that particular topic. So I can totally see it, especially if you're a purchasing agent for a corporation. Like, heads up, that's not a great place to be if you're, you know, you got a 20-year career ahead of you, and all you do is, you know, manage the relationship with the people that you pay. That's probably trouble. AI agents can easily make that happen. So the future is tough to predict, but there's going to be a lot of AI agents doing a lot of stuff, and it's going to be real soon.
Yeah, it's already taking off right now. I mean, this has been kind of a huge thing for 2025 is AI agents, and it's really just scratching the surface of, I mean, there's nowhere near a trillion at this point. So, but it's, yeah, I would not be surprised for it to get there faster than 15 years at the pace it's going.
No, I agree. Especially once they start doing the robots, and every robot's going to have an AI agent running it. So, I mean, how many? Yeah, okay. The Optimus robots from Tesla are going to be like 25, 30 grand. So there's not going to be a trillion of those. But those little vacuum cleaners that automatically go around and clean floors, or I mean, if I don't know how often you go grocery shopping, but like 9 times out of 10, the floor sweeper doesn't have a person on it. And every time I see a person driving the floor cleaner, I'm like, man, that's gotta suck. It's like, you know that that thing's cleaning on its own and you're just riding it at this point. So, you know, those, you know, every grocery store is going to have a floor cleaner that's got an AI agent that cleans the floor. Like there's going to be plenty. So yeah, that's the ones that have like a body. You don't need that, right? They can just live in a computer. And I mean, look at all these jobs. Most jobs are just sitting at a cubicle and staring at a screen, typing stuff in, like making things happen or whatever. I mean, AI agents can do that.
Oh yeah. So I was reading a little bit about XRP and the SEC, and they've been at battle for what, 5+ years at this point. They're trying to actually close a case between the two of them, but it seems like the New York court won't allow them to change anything. So we're waiting now if they're going to appeal it or just pay the fine and move on. But it's hilarious that they want to walk away. They've agreed to something, and now the court's saying, oh, you can't agree to that. We already said this.
So, yeah, New York courts. I'm pretty much done with New York courts. I don't really mind not hearing about XRP anymore, too. So this story is really not for me, Jason.
It's one of those, I feel like every, I don't know, fourth or fifth question I get about crypto is, what do you think about XRP? And I'm like, I'd rather not answer that question.
Like they have tenacious fans is what it feels like to me. It's like widespread panic. It's like, is the band that great or are their fans just crazy about them?
Yeah. So I did also see, we've talked about the Fold credit card. It got delayed. One of their partners apparently is exiting space. So not sure when it's going to happen at this point, which is a little disappointing. I mean, I still use the Gemini credit card, which is good, but it's almost everything's more closer to 1%. And there's a couple of things that are above that, but getting to a 2% rewards credit card across everything will be great at some point one day.
Yeah, I was thinking about Fold this week because so my son's going to be 13 next month, and I've been trying to keep him on a cash basis so that he can feel what it's like to pay for stuff and kind of how bad it sucks to break a 20, and then how once you break a 20, all those ones and fives just disappear, you know. So I want him to feel that, so he's kind of had that. He doesn't care, right? He's going to buy like potato chips. He spends money like a dummy, and so anyway, he's like, you know, we'll go to a local minor league baseball game or we'll go to something. And it's like cashless. And so I have to hand him a credit card and all that. And he's like, Dad, can I just get a debit card? And I'm like, well, I have this Fold card in my wallet. That's a debit card that if you spend on it, it will get Bitcoin rewards. So I'm like, all right, I'll pull my money off of it. And we'll put your money on it and then you can just have it. So the Fold debit card is going to get back put into use as soon as the traditional financial rails move money around that I tried to move 2 days ago and it still hasn't gone anywhere.
Oh goodness. Yeah.
Every time they say Bitcoin slow, I'm like, compared to what? I'm on day literally. This is like the full on 48 hours and nothing's moved.
That's wild. All right. Well, the last thing that I had on my end, and then we can see what else you had. So Rick Edelman, which I don't know if many people are familiar with, I paid attention to him a long time ago because he talked about just the kind of the power of using your mortgage and kind of carrying a big long mortgage. And well, he is the founder of Edelman Financial Engines. They're a $293 billion asset manager. He originally kind of came out and said a single digit allocation to digital assets is kind of the right way to go. He's changed his mind a little bit. So he is now telling people it should be at a minimum 10%, which is kind of crazy. 25% for moderate portfolios, and for aggressive portfolios, it needs to be 40% of your portfolio, which is a very high number compared to what we've been hearing. He's thinking the market's going to at least 5 to 10x by 2030. He says Bitcoin is going to probably be worth close to $19 trillion by 2030, which is like a 10x from here, which would be awesome, right? You're talking about $1 million Bitcoin. I mean, intriguing to see somebody at this caliber that's talking about the power of crypto and where it's going. And I don't think he's a dumb guy at all. If you go listen and read any of his stuff, he thinks about this pretty decently.
Yeah, I mean, when he
he's like 40% for highly aggressive portfolios. I'm like,
holy crap. Are people really going to go like, you know what?
He's right. 40%. Bang. Now I'm in Bitcoin at 40%. I don't feel like that's how it's going to work. I mean, if you get out and you just talk to people,
they are aware of Bitcoin and that's it. So you're talking about,
you know, people that have real money.
Even if you had a $1 million net worth or investable wealth, you're talking about dumping $400,000 into Bitcoin and buying 4 Bitcoin right now. 0 to 4 Bitcoin at $100,000 Bitcoin, I don't think that's going to happen. Not when you only have 6 Bitcoin that's living in fiat world. I mean, that's a really aggressive. So I'm
all for it. Don't get me wrong, but man, you'd really need to hold some people's hands to get them there. I mean,
it's very difficult to understand Bitcoin. It's even harder to turn dollars into Bitcoin because you don't understand Bitcoin, right? I mean, you can understand houses. It's easy to get into real estate. Gold is weird enough. Buying gold, like a bar of gold, is weird. Gold coin is weird. You know, like 40%, I'd love to see it. I think it'd be great for the people that do it. I feel like that's, you know,
that's like a Tom Lee, Michael Saylor thing to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's one of those things where it doesn't happen overnight. Everybody that I talk to, and I'm like, okay, start with $50 and go buy Bitcoin and make a couple of transactions. Don't start with $10,000 or $400,000, right? It's start small. And then once you understand it, it's like, oh yeah, this makes sense. Why would I not put it? I mean, if you gave me $1 million today, more than 40% of it would go into Bitcoin, to be honest with you. Yeah. But starting out, that is definitely not the case. You kind of have to start a little bit slow and understand it before you just drop everything in there.
Well, it's also, if you are given $1 million, it's very easy to throw it into Bitcoin. If you had to work for 20 years to save $1 million, it's very difficult to allocate that to Bitcoin. And, you know, I think people with a lot of money forget how hard it is to earn money. And then when you do, how difficult it is to invest in something that you perceive as risky, even if you just don't know the difference between volatility and risk. So like that's the hard part. So yeah, I mean, if you have $100 million net worth, throwing $10 million into Bitcoin is not a very difficult thing to do. Like, oh well, if it goes south, like a couple percentage points of my net worth will pick up the slack. When you're talking about 40 cents of every dollar you've ever saved over the course of your lifetime, it's really tough to throw it into something that's volatile. And it's likely that you don't understand the volatility risk issue, and you don't see, like, it's tough to zoom out. I mean, man, so my X feed is littered with MicroStrategy these days. And like, just the algorithm is on to me. And there's so many people that buy MicroStrategy stock, and every single day look at the price of MicroStrategy and look at the price of Bitcoin and are mad that MicroStrategy isn't 2x of whatever the Bitcoin daily changes every day. Like, that's crazy behavior. Like, that's not what this is all about at all. So no. These are people that are into Bitcoin and MicroStrategy that are worried about the daily price movement. So that to me is more like what a normal person would do if they put 40% of their net worth into Bitcoin.
Like, it would be like, they would never notice when it's up. They'd only notice when it's down, and they would sell it immediately. I think when it comes to Bitcoin, you have to go in slowly with a long-term mindset, ready for it to get cut in half.
That is true, because it probably will happen at some point.
Yeah, even if you double and then it gets cut in half, it's still awful.
Yeah, and when that happens multiple times over the history of you holding it, then it doesn't get any easier.
No, you think you have all these calluses and you're like resistant to it, and then it happens and you're like, oh my god, I should have done something 6 months ago. And you're like, what would you have done? Sold? No. Yeah. There's got to be something I can do. No, it sucks. And there's no way around it. It sucks. But it's one thing for it to suck with 1 or 2% of your portfolio, and you're like, yeah, this is what I expect, and blah, blah, blah. It's another thing if you're like, Oh, I'm risk. I'm very aggressive. I'll put 40% in, and then you're just not sleeping when it gets cut in half because you're not. You thought you were aggressive because you were buying tech stocks.
Oh, so true. What else did I miss?
I think the one thing we didn't talk about. I don't know if we even said the word Trump today, but
so
stock market all time high. Bitcoin closed at the highest price that it's ever closed in a month.
Basically, the market is sniffing something out, right? Like the market knows something's coming, and the something is liquidity. Donald Trump sent Jay Powell a note that had all of the central bank interest rates listed in order from smallest to largest, showing that the United States is all the way at the bottom with one of the largest interest rates, telling him how much money he's costing the U.S. taxpayer because we can't refinance the debt at a lower rate, and basically telling him he's being incredibly slow to react. And so I think that those two things are connected. I think that when the president of the United States puts pressure on the Fed to lower interest rates, I think the market knows that, and the market knows that with lower interest rates means more loans, and more loans means more dollars created out of thin air, and then more dollars created out of thin air means more money's going to find its way into all the assets. And so, and you know, that's why you've got, you know, Bitcoin is a liquidity sponge, and because it's a smaller asset class, it doesn't take as much money to boost the market cap and the price of Bitcoin. And I think that's why you see that happening, or at least partially why you see that happening. So, yeah, I think that was the only thing I had on my list that we didn't really touch on.
Yeah, I mean, and to put numbers to that, we're at 4.5%, and he wants to take it to 1%, right? I mean, imagine that happening. How much cash?
It's on, dude.
Holy
everybody,
cow.
I mean, everybody is making a move. All these people that are living in houses that they are grown out of, but they have a 2.75% interest rate, move stock or the real estate market booms. Everybody, the number of transaction booms, small business loans boom, everybody refinances boom, just cat. There's so much liquidity would be in the market, and it would be 2022. We saw what happens when they raise interest rates really fast and liquidity gets crunched. It sucked. When liquidity comes back, it goes up faster than it goes down, right? Because there's money on the sideline that's waiting for this kind of news. And so, yeah, at this point, here's the deal when it comes to dropping interest rates to 1%. When Trump came in, it was like, all right, this is Main Street's turn. You know, Wall Street's been winning for a decade or more. This is, you know, we're going to tariff and bring manufacturing jobs and build the middle class. And then, you know what? That didn't work. Elon, you know, Doge, they didn't do anything that Doge recommended. They don't talk about austerity. They don't talk about balanced budgets. They're talking about, let's just grow out of our debt, which means pump the money printer and screw the poor people, and rich people get super rich again. And so at this point, I'm fully allocated into Bitcoin. All my assets are in. I'm like, you know what? They're going to do it. So you might as well get yourself embedded in as many assets as you can. And if you're saving in dollars, you're toast.
Well, I think Powell's done in like May of 26. So we're a year away before he gets replaced. And I mean, they've already thrown out Scott Bessent's name to replace him. And they asked him what he would do. And he just said, I'd do whatever the president wants me to do. Right. So if that's the case, and I mean, we're a year away from rates going from 4.5 to 1% overnight, and this whole concept of this God candle where you see $100,000 Bitcoin candle is possible, right? I mean, it's going to be wild.
Oh man. When you start, here's the problem with the bull market is you start thinking about this stuff. I mean, if you go from 4.5 to 1% over 12 months, right? Skyrocket Bitcoin price. Everything's moving up. Well, you have all of these Bitcoin treasury companies, right? You have all of this options market behind the Bitcoin treasury companies. The supply squeeze and the gamma squeeze that you would see would force so much buying in the Bitcoin treasury. Just forget Bitcoin globally. The United States stock market Bitcoin requirements to cover the shorts would be crazy. Mm-hmm. And if that is fueled by the liquidity that you would get from a, even if you went from 4.5% to 3% interest, it would be crazy. So if those two things kind of happen at something like the same time, all of the Bitcoin, insane Max Keiser lunatic Bitcoin crap that I listen to, that it's the hugest turnoff, because like Bitcoin isn't a get rich quick scheme, right? It's a don't get poor scheme. So all of that crap could be just happen in 2026. If all of that went down, 2026, we could start it up $175,000 Bitcoin, and we get in at $800,000 Bitcoin. it's like there's an actual way that it could happen. Now you got to have a bit of a perfect storm for it to happen, but holy crap, dude, it's definitely not impossible. And if these guys, I mean, if they're going to run the same playbook, it's not impossible.
But the sad part is it's looking more probable, right? I mean, exactly to your point, where everything we thought Doge was going to do is getting thrown out the window, and nothing. They're not planning to do that at all. And they're saying
all they did was like, hey, look at all this waste. These guys aren't going to do anything about it. I'm going to go back and run Tesla. See y'all later.
Yeah. And I'm going to increase the federal deficit by $3 to $5 trillion over the next decade. So
yeah,
there's a crap ton of money that's going to just come in, and where's it going to go?
Yep. And if they lower interest rates, I mean, the infrastructure bill that Biden passed, that money's still flowing. Inflation Reduction Act, still adding to inflation. Like those big giant bills that we didn't need are still pumping. We're going to throw this bill that we don't need pumping. And if we lower interest rates, pumping. I mean, it's the money printer liquidity thing. When you compound it with what could happen with all of these Bitcoin treasury companies buying up the Bitcoin, and all of these companies not shorting it, expecting the price to go down, but cover, like just hedging themselves, right? Like when Bitcoin price goes up, these institutions, if they bought at 70 and it's at 100,000, they're going to insure their gains by doing a put at 90, right? So all of that stuff's going to have to be covered. If the price goes to 200, your 90's dead. What are you going to do? So or what is the person that sold you the put going to do? They got to buy. I mean, it's super stupid for a guy like me who's like super normal. Like we're just going to, every so often we're going to have these big years, and then we're going to kind of float. We're going to trudge our way to a million over the course of a decade. And then you got me like, holy crap, there is a path to high six-figure Bitcoin in 18 months. And if I'm thinking about that, you're going to have a whole bunch of people that don't know anything about Bitcoin listening to people that are going nuts saying that this is going to happen. You know, look at this. I mean, you could see an inflow of retail coming in based on that thesis. And maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't, but those are the people that are in, and then they get booted in a cycle, and then maybe they trickle back in, you know, over time. But, you know, you talk about like, you know, the 2017 bump, the 2020, you know, hyperbolic Bitcoin price rise. How could we possibly see that kind of volatility again? The law of big numbers, diminishing returns, all of the stuff that says we're not going to do it. And I'm like, well, there is a way where we can go from 16.5 this cycle to 600. And there's a path. It's kind of stupid, but it's kind of stupid that it exists, but it's not stupid to think that it would happen. It's stupid to expect it to happen, but it certainly could.
Well, if you haven't listened to Rob Paul lately, I mean, his whole thing is the banana zone, and it's all based on global liquidity. And I mean, the message that keeps sticking in my head from him is pretty much, don't fuck this up. Just buy and enjoy, because it's gonna go crazy. Now, what does crazy mean? Is it 10x? Is it 20x? Is it 50x? Right? Like no one really knows, but it's gonna be 3X. Something. Yeah, it's gonna be something kind of crazy from that 16.5 number, right? So it's gonna be.
Oh yeah, from 16.5, 20x is on the table for sure. I mean, you got guys like me that are looking at refinancing their primary residence to buy Bitcoin. Figure out a way to justify it to the wife. hey, cash flow every month, we're break even, same payment, but we have the, you know, an extra Bitcoin or so, you know, sitting pretty, you know, when you got guys like me doing that, it's bull market time for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, Hal, this has been a lot of fun. I'm excited about the next few weeks, few months, 12 months.
We're going to have 2-hour podcasts if we keep doing this, man.
Yeah. Holy cow. Like it's crazy to see all the positive things going on in this space and all the potential, right? I mean, we're still scratching the surface on so much of this, and I'm jumping at the bit to see what's going to happen next week with a lot of the stuff, even though it's going to take months for some of the stuff to happen. It's still amazing how quickly other things are happening from other companies in other countries.
Yep. Totally agree.
Awesome. We'll talk again next week.
Same to you.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below, and hope to see you there.